Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound. It's Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning we're going to pick up on a conversation we started last year with a spokesperson from the Connecticut Department of Health talking about how state employers are coming to grips with the opioid epidemic and how it's affecting their employees and family members of those in their workforce. We'll dig into a newly released white paper on the subject and clue you in on where to go for guidance if you discover one or more of your employees is dealing with an opioid-related addiction or crisis in their home. Then we'll meet Connecticut's Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to talk about the agency and how it's responding to the current needs of state veterans, whether they are serving now or have served in the past. We'll discuss how the agency can help support vets through advocacy and residential programs, as well as learn how they can benefit from the veteran-owned small business certification program for state contracts. Then we'll close introducing you to Aware Recovery Care and their unique and innovative in-home addiction treatment programs that were founded on the research support idea that recovery in the real world leads to far better rehabilitation results. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. If you're involved with hiring and managing workers or you're a human resources professional, you'll want to sign up now for the 2019 CBIA Human Resources Conference. It's happening on March 21st at the Red Lion Hotel Conference Center in Cromwell. This day-long event is packed with networking opportunities, dynamic industry speakers, and breakout workshops, including sessions on handling medical and recreational marijuana issues, recruiting and retention, recognizing and supporting workers who are victims of domestic violence, and a state legislative update on HR-related issues coming up at the current Statehouse session. You can register today by calling 860-244-1977 or just visit cbia.com/events. Well, it's great to hear the voice of a friend on the line this morning. We are picking up where we left off with a conversation with Deborah Pease from the Connecticut Department of Public Health. She's a project leader on a white paper initiative that is dealing with the opioid crisis in Connecticut's workforce. And she is an epidemiologist with DPH and has been with the agency for about 20 years. So we'll just set this up by saying that the current opioid crisis has had a far-reaching effect on all aspects of our society here in Connecticut, across the country, including and maybe especially employers, or maybe uniquely employers. A couple of years ago, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health estimated more than 21 million, almost 22 million adults needed substance abuse treatment, and many of those adults were workers struggling to maintain their employment status and financial livelihoods while they sought help. So when we first met Deborah, she was in the early stages of finalizing the draft of a white paper and initiative through the Connecticut Department of Health that's actually aimed at Connecticut's workforce, human resources managers, company owners, and anyone who may be in a position to encounter or deal with an employee who themselves is a current or recovering opioid addict, or may have a loved one, a family member who is grappling with opioid addiction, because certainly if it's a child, a parent, a loved one, someone who's a housemate, a spouse, that is going to have a significant impact on you as a worker, even if you are not the one who is going through recovery or engaged in the addiction. So, Deborah, how am I doing so far?
You're doing great.
So
thank you for having me on.
Well, I'm going to shut up now and let you talk. But suffice to say, we are at the end of a chapter for you as well, because you've gone from development to publishing. So let's go back in time to even before we talked during our first interview around this time, maybe like last spring, to talk about when you and the agency really started seeing both an issue and an opportunity to bridge the DPH's expertise with folks in the Connecticut labor force, human resources professionals, and Connecticut employers who may have an addicted employee or an employee who's got an addicted loved one?
Yes. So in the spring of 2016, you know, we started hearing and seeing everything in the news about the opioid epidemic and families and the tragic stories of overdose. But what we weren't seeing at the time in the news was anything about opioid addiction and workers. So that was kind of like our initial premise of thinking about it from that perspective. And we were wondering, you know, where do someone who's, you know, using substances such as opioids, where do they work? And how do they support themselves financially? So once we started to have all these questions, started to think, you know, what impact are they having on the workplace? And that kind of, and we already knew that workers were injured on the job, and that there's been always for history, you know, time mm-hmm. and time again, sure. that people are injured on the job and they need pain medication. And they stay out for some period of time and then they have to get back to work. You know, the workplace needs them and they need to get back to work financially. So we started to recognize, well, how do they get back into work? And so we were thinking a lot of people may go back too soon. And so once we started thinking about all these things, putting them all together, then we realized this is a bigger issue. And it does affect workplaces. And actually, we had the first symposium in March 1st of 2017, and then our second symposium was October 4th of 2017. And during that time, there was some national studies that came out that said 70% of employees are employed while in recovery. And when you look at that statistic, you think, wow, this is really affecting the workplace. Whether they know it or not, it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the point of sort of the point of convergence between the member of potential point of convergence between the employee and the addiction, because while certainly there may be a subsegment of individuals who have come to abuse or become addicted to opioids for different reasons, you're actually expressing the same kind of outcry or concern that we're hearing from folks like football coaches for young students and athletes. You've got people who, through the course of their work, usually through no fault of their own, they become injured. They, especially up to the past maybe a year or so ago, when doctors have started to become much more hyper aware and have started prescribing or offering alternate types of pain management, you know, the standard course of procedure was you go to the doctor, they give you maybe physical therapy, but they also treat the pain with some sort of pharmaceuticals, oftentimes opioids, and we hear the stories, and you know all too well, being with the Department of Public Health, that, you know, it might not take more than a few days of taking high-powered opioids for someone to want to keep taking them, even if it seems that the pain has gone away.
Yeah, so what happens is that the body becomes very dependent on the drug, and they can't not use it. It's almost as if it goes
relieving the pain to having pain when you don't take the opioid.
Well, right. So they do that, but then addicts are no longer like just abusing opioids for the high. They go to using them to prevent themselves from getting sick too.
Mm-hmm.
So it has this cycle.
Yes. So the idea came out of collaboration with employers through those two symposiums that really kind of got this finished product rolling.
Yep, definitely. So our first symposium was looking more at workers being injured on the job and then becoming dependent on pain medication because they, you know, maybe went back to work too soon. But then through that symposium, we developed a wish list, and from that wish list, on the very top of it was, how can we help employers, and what can we do to, help them understand what is addiction and what are the resources that they can use, and then even looking at the policies. And so we started delving into it and realizing that the policies, you know, were outdated. You know, they're 30, 40, 50 years outdated. And really now, with this whole opioid epidemic, we've realized that employers now need to start looking at their policies, making changes, and the changes they need to make are to try to support and encourage the worker to get treatment and help them through the recovery process. And that's going to be the most cost effective for employers, whether it's big or small. And that's a big change. That's a cultural shift, and it's, you know, one that doesn't have a lot of stigma. And unfortunately, you know, that's what we need to remove, and that's what we're really up against. And so I think if an employer is listening to this right now, they may say, well, why is it my responsibility? Well, it's going to help them, and it's going to help the worker. And at the end of the day, you know, that's the hope is, and understanding and support is what someone in treatment or recovery needs. Mm. And if you read the foreword, actually, in the white paper by David Messenger, at the very end, he says, as a person in recovery, this is a very exciting time. A document like this gives me hope. And he says, at the end of the day, sometimes hope is all that someone needs. Mm. And to me, every time I read that, I get goosebumps because really, that's what the essence is of this white paper and these symposias that we held, and we had 250 people at them, over 17 speakers. This last symposium was 17 speakers. The one before that, I don't know, 10 speakers we had. So there were a lot of stakeholders and partnerships in putting this paper together.
Yeah. Well, we've talked a lot on this program with other agencies and contractors about how Connecticut has become a national leader in transitioning folks from incarceration back into society and the workforce. And this looks like an opportunity for the Connecticut Department of Health to not only be the state's leader, but maybe a national leader in initiating a new movement among human resources professionals, employers, company owners, and others to begin to shed what probably exists today in HR manuals and employee practices, employee-employer practices, to almost indirectly punish the individual or take some punitive action by immediately firing or dismissing someone if they discover that individual is either actively engaged in an addiction or even worse is seeking recovery and still maintaining their work responsibility. So you know what we talked about the last time and what you just mentioned is really pertinent, and that is the bottom line is the top point of our discussion here, and that is why it is more cost effective and can create greater, employee loyalty and retention and really make a much more positive difference and remove a burden on society by working with their worker in regards to recovery.
Absolutely, John. I presented at a national meeting, and Connecticut is at the forefront on this issue in developing this white paper. It's very unique in a way that we are thinking ahead of what's going on, and usually from a government perspective, it's always reacting. So instead, we're forward kind of thinking and really moving at the forefront, and hopefully it does get national press. That would be wonderful.
So, turning to the white paper and an accompanying brochure that now is publicly available, members of the workforce can go right to a sub-site on the Connecticut Department of Health's website to download both the white paper and brochures that are available. So, reverting back in the last few minutes that we have to the white paper, what are a couple of the high points that emerged? You know, we talked about it in process the last time we visited, Deborah, but now that you're looking back on the finished product, what were a couple of the most important high points that that stuck out for you that you'd like to remind employers about?
I think what I'd like to at least remind is that, you know, early identification, understanding the signs and symptoms of addiction is very crucial to getting someone into treatment and recovery. I think, you know, people tend to kind of go down a road, a path, so to speak, too far. And if you can identify those things very early on as an employer or a supervisor or even a coworker, I think that will help put people into, get them on the right path of treatment and recovery. So I think early identification training is really crucial, updating policies, providing that instant support. And it's not just here's a 1-800 number where they can seek treatment. It's more, you know, get your ducks in a row, network with treatment facilities or partnership with treatment facilities and EAP to try to have all these things in ducks in a row, mm-hmm. so that when someone needs help, you have everything you need to support them. And part of that instant support is also providing them flexibility and then keeping the lines of communication open for the employee and the supervisor. Like regular review, regular check-ins. Once you know there's something going on, try to keep that line of communication open. I think that is really going to be crucial because it'll make the person feel good that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, but then also there's someone there that has compassion and understanding for them. And I think that's going to keep people in recovery. And then enlisting success, maybe try to find other peer-to-peer kind of programs. We talk about it in the white paper about member assistance programs and things like that, but try to partnership and work with the treatment facilities or the EAP programs so that they understand what the responsibilities are for that employee and how can you modify the system or their workday to give them the flexibility that they need or to do their job if they're in recovery, because it's a huge responsibility for them to go through this. So I think just keeping that understanding and that dialogue open, I think, is crucial for everyone to understand.
Yeah, and being armed with the tools available now through this white paper, including the all-important instruction on implementing 5 key principles for supportive substance abuse policies, at the end of the day, also plays a critical role in helping to begin to convert our society from looking at opiate-addicted individuals as second-class citizens, as rejects, as something being wrong with them, a weakness in that individual, and really supports what we've been trying to do here on the award-winning For the People for so many years, and that is to break down the stigmas. An employee walking around with that huge weight on their shoulder that they're hiding an addiction or they're hiding the fact that their morale or their work is being impacted because of a loved one's addiction. I mean, kudos to the Connecticut Department of Health and you and your team for being one of the first agencies in the country to really take hold of this initiative and make it happen with this white paper. So before we let you go, Deborah, just let folks know once again how they can access this important resource.
Yes. So they can go to the www.ct.gov /DPH/occupational health. And then once they get to the occupational health unit, they can kind of scroll down and there'll be activities, and then just click on opioid use and Connecticut's workforce, and that'll bring them right to the white paper, the brochure, and the two symposias that we had previously in 2017.
Excellent. Substance use and abuse has been increasing at a drastic rate in the U.S. and Connecticut in recent years, and is certainly impacting Connecticut's workforce. It's great to hear the culmination of this phase of the work of the Connecticut Department of Health and our guest, project leader Deborah Pease, this morning in regards to this white paper on the opioid crisis in Connecticut's workforce. If you are a company owner, an owner-operator who has contractors or staff, you're a human resources professional for a company, large or small, I encourage you to visit the website and check this out and keep your eyes on the Connecticut Department of Health for future symposiums, workshops, and additional information on this subject. Certainly, you can look to us here at the award-winning For the People as we continue our conversation with the Connecticut DPH and Deborah as this project rolls out in the future. So, Deborah, we say farewell for now, and thank you so much for your time, and we will be talking to you again soon. Well, in our continuing effort to provide information and support to all of the veterans and veterans' families here in Connecticut, we take every opportunity to check in with the Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs, and we're so pleased to welcome Thomas Soddy onto the program. He is our current commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs. He is a major in the U.S. Army Reserve, a member of the Danbury City Council, and a former Assistant Connecticut Attorney General and Special Prosecutor. So he has worn a lot of hats in his professional history, to name a few, but we have him now, and he, being a service person, being someone who's engaged on the front line of constituent-driven services in his capacity on the Danbury City Council, he is uniquely qualified to be able to work with and handle our Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs. So we're so pleased to welcome you, Tom. Thanks for being on the program.
Well, John, thank you so much for having me and for your support for veterans and getting information out related to Veterans Affairs.
Yeah. So we kind of touched on some of the high points of your more recent history. When did you, I guess it's more important to say, at what point in your life did you become engaged in the military? When did you go into service?
Well, I actually sort of followed a slightly non-traditional route. I didn't enter the U.S. Army Reserve until I was 35 years old. I direct commissioned in after practicing law for about 6 years with the state of Connecticut at the Office of the Attorney General, and there was a program for direct commissioning into what's known as the JAG Corps, the Judge Advocate General Corps, so basically an Army lawyer. And so when I was 35 years old, I took the oath back in November of 2005, November 10th, the day before Veterans Day, and have been serving ever since.
Very good. Well, it's suffice to say, and we have talked about this with every Veterans Affairs Commissioner and representative of your department, going back my 28 plus years on the program, that Connecticut has a lot of agencies and organizations that are the first of their kind in the country, and that is something that your department actually shares.
Yes, in fact, the Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs goes back to what was known as the Fitch home for widows and orphans and veterans, and was begun by Benjamin Fitch here in Connecticut in Darien. He himself was a Civil War veteran in 1864. It was the first of its kind in the nation, and it is the oldest continuously operating veterans home. Now, of course, we're the Department of Veterans Affairs under state statute, and it was probably at the turn of the 19th century when the state stepped in as the home was having fiscal problems and took on the public responsibility of caring for veterans, and has done so ever since.
And at what point did everything shift to the Rocky Hill campus?
Under the Roosevelt administration, as many people were aware, there were these large building programs, WPA, and the Rocky Hill campus was constructed in the 1930s and early 40s, and in 1940, the residents who were living at Darien, at the Fitch home there, traveled up and took occupancy here in Rocky Hill, and we've operated ever since here at the Rocky Hill campus. There is a residential facility. At one time it was a surgical hospital. Now it's a healthcare center, and we also have family housing on our campus, but I know we'll discuss more details of that a little bit later in the program.
Yeah, I was going to say, starting with reviewing some of the core functions of the agency, long-term healthcare is something that's been a constant since post-Civil War era.
Absolutely, and you know, many people who know this campus going back decades would recall that there was a surgical hospital. We now have what's known as a chronic disease hospital. However, what's very important for listeners to understand is we are transitioning from a chronic disease hospital to a skilled nursing facility with specialized care. And the short version of why we're doing that is we have done an analysis of the demographics in Connecticut of veterans, of our current veteran residents and our patient population and those on our waiting list. And that is a type of care that is needed as we have an aging population and they live longer at an older age. That skilled nursing care rather than hospital or surgical care is what we believe we can provide and should provide here at State Veterans Affairs in Rocky Hill. And so we're engaged in that transition now. It's a heavy lift, but it will allow us to serve more Connecticut veterans in a better way at our healthcare center.
Yeah, and I imagine with the fact that in West Haven you have this VA health facility, is there a lot of overlap or connect now to that agency in providing services that maybe up to now were coordinated through or provided by Connecticut's Department of Veterans Affairs?
Excellent question. We have a great partnership with the federal VA healthcare system, both at the West Haven campus as well as with Newington. And the majority of those veteran residents we have here on our campus and our patients, they receive their care, primary care, surgical care, and others from the VA, West Haven, and Newington, do tens of thousands of veterans across the state of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And we coordinate care, we co-manage care, and over the decades, it predates my tenure here, is eliminating duplicative services. And so now we coordinate that care, so we are utilizing limited dollars in a much more efficient way. Mm-hmm. And we continue to grow that partnership with the federal VA, West Haven, and Newington.
And the residential service support you provide is not exclusive to the Rocky Hill facility?
The distinction here is the federal VA doesn't provide directly residential programs and services. We at the Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs in Rocky Hill have a residential facility for individual veterans. We also have 5 family homes across the street from our main campus for veterans who have dependents, either a spouse and or children, as well as support programs within the community and work with community-based organizations to move those individuals in our residential programs back to community-based housing and employment, hopefully sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. But we do that through wraparound services and an overall program for both physical and mental health. But the only residential facilities that we do have under the Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs are here in Rocky Hill.
Okay, but not necessarily institutional. You do have the group homes as well, proximate to the main campus.
Yeah, so our family housing and is across the street, but that is part of our sort of extended campus.
Sure.
And we also, in our main residential facility for individual veterans, both male and female, and we have a secure female wing.
Oh, okay.
So that's often a question, do you take female residents?
Yeah.
We absolutely do. And our family housing is very important because these families would potentially not be able to go to a shelter. They could be separated because they have minor children or other needs that just simply wouldn't be taken care of in another setting. And that's why our 5 family homes are so important. They are time limited at 24 months, and we have we have robust case management that supports the families there so that we can move them back to community-based housing and hopefully community-based employment if they're unemployed when they're with us.
Great. Well, if you're a veteran or someone who loves one or a family member of a veteran, you'll want to stick with us through the break when we return to talk with Commissioner of Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs, Thomas Soddy, right after our brief interlude here. We're going to be talking about the advocacy and assistance programming, cemetery and memorial services availability, as well as the veteran-owned small business certification program with the commissioner. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a few moments. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Have you heard of the Tiny Miracles Foundation? Well, it's a nonprofit dedicated to helping families with premature babies through compassionate care and support. Their services and programs are provided in the neonatal units of Stamford, Norwalk, Bridgeport, and Danbury hospitals and at St. Vincent's Medical Center. In an effort to provide valuable resources and practical help for parents with premature babies, the Tiny Miracles Foundation has announced their After the NICU Education Series for 2019 with their first program, Sleep Health and Transitions, with Dr. John Cianella, the neonatologist at Stamford Hospital. It's coming up on January 29th from 6 to 7:30 at the Wilton Congregational Church, Pilgrim Hall. The program and dinner is free but RSVPs are required. If you'd like more information or to click through to RSVP for the event, just visit ttmf.org. All right. Well, if you're a veteran or you know someone or love someone who is, you're a family member of a veteran in service or someone who has passed their period of service, you'll want to stick with us for the rest of our chat with Thomas Soddy. He is the Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Veterans Affairs, also a major in the U.S. Army Reserve and a former Assistant Connecticut Attorney General and Special Prosecutor. He is a resident in Danbury and serves on their city council, busy guy, but never too busy to help promote the great work of the Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs. So, Thomas, transitioning into advocacy and assistance, let's talk about the help that you can provide.
The Department of Veterans Affairs Office of Advocacy and Assistance is an amazing entity. We have 5 district offices, 1 in each of our congressional districts, and we thank our federal and municipal partners for giving us space that we don't have to pay for, which allows us to focus our dollars on advocacy and assistance. And what our veteran service officers do, our VSOs, is provide free representation to qualified veterans and their eligible dependents in applying for and obtaining federal, state, and local health care benefits, pensions, tax abatements, and the list goes on. They are free. They provide the service free. It is advocacy to connect our veterans and obtain those programs and services that they earned through their military service. And we have these 5 district offices, so individuals can go there, walk in, call, make appointments. We also hold community-based panels, as well as go out to the vet centers that are around the state and hold open office hours there to bring the message out, provide information to our veterans, to their family members, to how to connect them with benefits and services that they earned.
One of the other benefits is this cemetery and memorial service assistance.
Yeah, so we have 3 veteran cemeteries in Connecticut. The original one in Darien, due to being at capacity, closed in the 1980s. Our main veteran cemetery is in Middletown. And we also are very thankful for the town of Middletown and the Middletown Veterans Council and veterans organizations across the state for supporting all of our core functions, but also for very much supporting events as well as supporting family members when they come to inter a veteran at our Middletown Cemetery. And oftentimes, there may be somebody who didn't have anyone to be there for them, so veterans will come from around the state and be there at that final internment of our veterans. So at our Middletown Cemetery, it is open to all eligible veterans, residents of the state of Connecticut, or if they entered military service through Connecticut. And we have 2 major projects going on there now, one which we are just in the final phases of completing, which is an expansion project that will add thousands of burial plots there so that we can expand the life of the cemetery, as well as an appearance improvement project, realigning the stones, cleaning them. We have volunteer organizations who have provided work in taking trees down and really opening that cemetery up so that the appearance matches the hallowed grounds and the service that those individuals who are interred there provide to this country. It is not just a place where people are buried. It is a place where people are revered and will be revered for generations and is visited every day by people from not only across Connecticut but across the region, across the nation, to pay respect to their loved ones. So these are very important projects. You know, I want to step back, though, to the Office of Advocate Assistance for a moment.
Sure.
That it's not just the direct advocacy provided to veterans, but other programs that we have, which I think you touched upon, is certifying veteran-owned small businesses. And we provide that certification process or program, and those veteran-owned small businesses can then bid and on state contracts, and they have a 15% bidding preference when they do that. We also administer the Connecticut Wartime Service Medal Program, as well as verify eligibility for veterans to receive the veteran indication flag on their driver's license. And on another side, in the criminal justice system, veterans do have certain programs that are available to them. We certify eligibility for some of the pretrial diversionary programs. And the reason for those is veterans, particularly combat veterans, have unique experiences that they've gone through and also unique issues that they are dealing with, particularly when you have individuals that are suffering from PTSD Sure. or traumatic brain injury or other military-related physiological impacts. And that sometimes can be directly correlated or related to difficulties that they're having in life. So we work on that with the criminal justice system in trying to get our veterans connected with those programs that are available to them to give them that second chance in life.
Very good. In the last minute or so that we have with you, Commissioner Saadi, please let folks know that they can honor Connecticut's veterans living and past by actually being a volunteer in some capacity with the department.
Absolutely. I encourage anyone to jump onto our website, which is www.portal.ct.gov/DVA, or just Google Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs. We could not do our job here at the department without volunteers and our community-based partners, our statewide veteran service organizations, our other state agencies and federal agencies that we partner with. But volunteers and donors are key in assisting us in engaging in our collective mission of serving those who are served. And people can go right on our website, they can volunteer, they can donate, they can find other ways to support our veterans. And oftentimes it's veterans supporting other veterans. And I must just put a shout out to our Connecticut veterans community and veteran service organizations. They do yeoman's work every day serving their brothers and sister veterans and serving our current military personnel. And I want to just thank those who swore that oath to protect and defend this country, all our veterans in Connecticut, all our current service members. I want to thank them for their service. It's their service that allows us to live in this free and democratic country, and we must never forget that.
Great. Thank you. Commissioner Thomas Saadi with the Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs, providing all of the services that you heard about and more, as well as operating the oldest continuously operating veterans home here in Connecticut, the largest continuously operating veterans home in the United States right here in Connecticut under Commissioner Saadi's leadership. So with all the excitement going on up in Rocky Hill, I predict our next visit, Commissioner Saadi, will be on site with you so you could show us all the fantastic new improvements going on in Rocky Hill. But until then, we'll bid you farewell for today and thank you for your service. Well, if you had tuned into the earliest segment of our program today, you heard about this exciting new development through the Connecticut Department of Health that is providing brand new ways of supporting state employers and those in the workforce with individuals who either themselves have an opioid addiction or who are caring for a loved one who's grappling with opioid addiction. And we were so pleased at the same time that we were able to make the acquaintance of Shelley Halligan. She's director of clinical services for Aware Recovery Care. Aware Recovery Care's unique in-home addiction treatment program was founded and started a little over 7 years ago on a research-supported concept that recovery in the real world leads to far better rehabilitation results. So we're going to talk about what you might expect if you engage with Aware Recovery Care. But first, let's meet Shelley Halligan. Shelley, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's go back to the time before you became a leader with Aware Recovery Care. Tell us a little bit about your background.
I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner, and I have been in the field of substance use disorder and treatment for about 15 years. And so I have worked not only with that population, but also populations that have a mental health diagnosis along with a substance use disorder as well.
Very good. So beyond the brief introduction, let's talk a little bit about how you learned about this opportunity and the science behind providing in-home addiction treatment.
It's really unique because what we have historically been doing is we have been sending people away to treatment facilities for a period of time, 30, 60 days, and people go away and they get a traditional treatment for their substance use disorder. And often when they leave there, they get great information while they're away. They get great treatment while they're away. But when they go back into their home, they don't have that same treatment set up. They don't have that therapist. They don't have that primary care provider. They don't have meetings, 12-step meetings, if they choose to go that route for their recovery. They don't have a fitness program or a nutritionist set up within their communities. And so what we do is we go into the individual's home, into their community. We include their family, their loved ones, their spouse, their supportive network, and we build that network around that individual for their home, for their community. So when they're at work, they get home and they're able to meet with their teams. We work around individual schedules. They don't have to leave and go away and come back and try to recreate what they learned far away in their hometown.
And it appears, based on information I'm seeing on your website, that this is something that has been accepted and in fact embraced by the insurance industry due to its success.
Absolutely. We're very fortunate that Anthem has been our partner throughout this, and they saw the benefit and they saw the great success that we're having, and that not only partnering us here in Connecticut, but throughout. And they have been an amazing partner for us to be able to, and a resource guide to help us to know where we're able to go in moving next. So we are started here in Connecticut, and next we opened up in New Hampshire, and we have a new office that has opened up in Maine, mm-hmm. and we'll soon be in the state of Florida. And so we are expanding based on what it looks like, where the greatest need is, and we work with Anthem along with that, as well as other insurance carriers. But Anthem has been our first partner and the one that has really been the one that stepped outside the box and believed in us and saw the data that we were really successful in what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. Was this based on some sort of a clinical test model that came out of research done here in Connecticut or elsewhere?
Here in Connecticut, yes. Some research that was done here with an addiction psychiatrist and the data showing that when we set up treatment within a person's home and in their community, they do so much better having their support system right there in their home and to be able to recover in home.
Mm-hmm. And is this a patented system, or are there, for lack of a better term, like sister initiatives or programs that are similar to it that are operating elsewhere?
We are the first and only and originator of the IHAT model, which is in-home addiction treatment. Mm-hmm. We are the first ones and the originators of that, and we are the only certified in-home addiction treatment recovery supports that we have. We have specialists that are certified in that IHAT model. So we are the only ones that are doing that. And then, fortunately, being the pioneers of that, we are able to have known all of the intricate parts of it and how to test it and how to make it that unique, special in-home addiction treatment model that we have created.
Very good. So for people who are in need of this program, how do they learn about you or get referred for possible treatment under this model?
Well, they can certainly go to our website. They can also call our phone number. They can call us, and they can if they need to, they can call. It is 203-779-5799, mm-hmm. And they can get in touch with one of our outreach individuals, intake specialists, and if that's a personal reference. We also get references from psychiatrists, from psychiatric nurse practitioners, from other treatment facilities, because we do know that there is benefit for individuals going away. So let's say that somebody does want to go away to treatment. We work in tandem and collaboratively with treatment facilities that when they leave those facilities, that we are part of their aftercare program. So that aftercare, once they leave home, we get discharge clients all the time directly to our care. So after they leave treatment, they can work with us for that year because we are a 52-week program. After they leave treatment, they can work with us, and we can have all those set up for their set up. We can have all those services set up for them as well.
Mm. Given the monstrous scope of the problem and the grip that opioids have, not only on us here in Connecticut, but across the country. People approach recovery and oftentimes are not successful the first time or even the second or third time. Do you at Aware Recovery Care interact with prior professionals who have provided care or addiction services to the client in prior attempts at recovery?
Absolutely. You know, that's the great thing about us and why we're not the only addiction treatment out there, but we're an alternative. And we know that addiction is a chronic lifetime disease. It's not one and done. You're not going to ever be cured of this. We know that, you know, it may reoccur at any time in someone's life. We also know that individuals go away and have had multiple attempts at treatment and have been unsuccessful. We're a great fit for someone like that has not had the alternative treatment for an in-home addiction treatment. So we can come in, and like I said, it's a 52-week. We're with you for an entire year, and you really become part of the Aware family. We know we get to celebrate everything that happens in that entire year, birthdays, Christmas, holidays, Thanksgiving, New Year's Eve. We're there. So it's not just this blip in your life where we come in and out. We're with you for that entire year. We get to know your family. We get to know your therapist. We get to know your primary care provider. And we get to know your community. And so with the vast amount of individuals that are battling addiction, the other really great thing about us is we have about 80% of our staff who are in recovery themselves. So it's not unusual for us. We really get it. We understand what addiction looks like. We understand what addiction feels like. And we walk alongside that individual from the time they get here until the time they graduate. We also know that once they do graduate, once they do leave our program, they may need us as well. So we can be their aftercare for that as well. So we really get it. We really get the whole realm of addiction and how difficult it can be. We work with families because, you know, by the time they come to us, oftentimes if they have been in multiple treatment facilities, they're frustrated, they're full of fear, they're scared, they don't really know what to do with their loved ones. So we have a whole family systems that we educate and we support the family alongside the client. So it's not It's not just that we work with the client. We work with the client, the family, and the extended family.
Hmm. Do you find that anecdotally clients that you've talked to who have had multiple failed attempts before being successful with Aware Recovery Care's program, this in-home team approach was the right fit for the right moment in their recovery process?
We have found that. And what makes it so unique is that it's completely individualized for that client. You know, when you're working in a brick-and-mortar building and facility and you're running groups, you're unable to do really unique individual care. You're not really able to say, hey, this person wants to do ballroom dancing, or this person really wants to go back to playing rugby, or this person really is engaged when he's using technology. We're able to do that because we have a whole team working with that one client, and that's what their focus is. We're not trying to engage an entire group. We work and find exactly what really is that person's passion. Maybe it's nutrition. Maybe they want to include that as part of their recovery. Maybe they want to attend belly dancing classes. Maybe they really love going back to church.
Mm-hmm.
We find what really sparks that passion in that client, and then we explode with that. We just really surround them with all these things that they can do, and we show them how much incredibly fun recovery can be, because if it wasn't, we wouldn't stay in it, right? I mean, we want to show them that living without drugs and alcohol is not just possible, but it's amazing.
I imagine a substantial bump that one has to overcome, possibly with that support network of family members and friends and community, is working with everyone but the individual at the center of the treatment on getting over the stigma.
We do know that that is a really big issue, and that's the other benefit, again, that so many of us that work for Aware Recovery Care are individuals in long-term recovery. So there certainly isn't any stigma from us, you know, that we understand this is a disease just as if you had had a heart attack, or if you had breast cancer, or if you had diabetes. We treat it the exact same way. This is a disease. We educate the family around that. We educate the client around that. And by lowering that and letting them know that there's no judgment here, there's no stigma here, clients really feel like they're part of, they're understood. We're speaking their language. So they're more apt to be able to buy into that recovery lifestyle and understanding that it is possible, because we know so many people who have done it. And we educate the family around that too, around stigma. And we're at the point now where we have got just an entire generation that is dying from this disease. Mm. If we don't change our attitude and let go of that stigma, this is just going to continue. We have to all rally around this and say, whatever your thoughts are, is it a disease or it's not a disease? It's a thing that we have got to address.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the last few minutes that we have with you, Shelley, whether somebody's been through an unsuccessful at recovery programs multiple times in the past, or whether they're coming to Aware Recovery Care for the first time, just walk us through a few of the things that people should expect to experience when they make the connection and invite you in to help them.
Well, the first thing that you can expect is that you're going to be given a thorough psychiatric evaluation. You're going to be given, an ASAM, as we call it, to find out exactly what your needs are. We're going to pick a team that's specifically going to suit you, a gender match, a story match, meaning females are usually with females, males are usually with males, age match, so we're going to have someone who's in the same generation as you, and then a story match. If your substance choice is alcohol, we're going to find someone for your team that's had the same struggles as you. And, if we have someone who is, let's say, a first responder, we're going to try to find someone who's in that, who's had that experience as well. A nurse that is struggling with, has been diverting meds, which happens. We're going to find someone who's a healthcare professional to work with you. So we try to do that. That's the first thing that we do before you even start with us. A lot of times, time goes into that before you even begin your program with us. And then that team goes into the home, and they have a first home visit, we call it, and we check the house. We do a safety check for the house, and then we start right away with a curriculum and our own curriculum that we've created, and we find out what is your passion, what sparks in you. And if they don't know, which a lot of people early in recovery don't know yet, we start offering things and surrounding you with things until we find what that passion is. And like I said, then we just really go down that road and just open up more doors for you. We know that the life of a person who is actively in addiction gets very, very small and very, very lonely. And our job is to open it up and include as many people and support systems as we can offer.
Fantastic. Well, the only place that you will find this unique and innovative in-home addiction treatment program is with Aware Recovery Care. They're here in Connecticut as well as New Hampshire, Maine, and growing into other states or established in other states as well. If you are engaged in a addiction or you know or love someone who is, whether it's here in Connecticut or one of the other states, they serve Aware Recovery Care realizes that a recovery in the real world leads to better rehabilitation results. Get to know them by visiting awarerecoverycare.com. Their director of clinical services, who's been with them from the very beginning, is Shelley Halligan. She was our guest this morning. Shelley, fantastic to meet you. Exciting to hear about this new tool, relatively new tool in the box, that is being so successful with individuals in recovery. And we will be talking to you again at some point to catch up and see both how the program is expanding elsewhere in the country and about new developments as your organization makes them happen. So thanks for being on the program and helping us close out the show. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.